It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook just a wee.
So the following year, how much harder was it for you, Curtis, coming in as the defending champion?
Oh, it wasn't bad. It wasn't bad. I wasn't playing great. It was a lot of white noise around going in, you know, about defending. It was a really, really hard golf course in Oak Hill, long. If we didn't have all those rains Wednesday morning, I think we'd still be up there trying to finish that golf course. It was so hard and fast and deep rough. But nobody said anything about winning back to back. I didn't know who the last guy was because nobody had done it in 40 some years. Jack, Lee, Watson, Arnie, the greats of the game hadn't done it. And so, you know, I just wanted to play well, you know, do my best, give myself a chance. But do you think about winning again? No, I never was good enough to stand on the first tee Thursday morning and say, I'm going to win this week, or I think I can win this week. You got to let the tournament come to you and let momentum build as the tournament progresses. And it progressed in a hurry. I shot 64 on Friday and on a golf course that I didn't think anybody would shoot 64 on. And so I was thrust into the lead. And so all of a sudden, Saturday morning in the papers, I'm reading, so Ben Hogan is the last guy to win back to back. And I didn't know who the hell was. So I said, well, what the hell? And I thought to myself, you know, reading the paper, and that's one thing I really dearly miss sitting here with you guys right now, is reading the paper every morning. But anyway, I said, well, Ben Hogan, what, Jack, how can Jack not have done it, or Trevino, or Arnie, or all the greats of the game? And so anyway, I went out there playing with Kite on Saturday, and I didn't play very well at all. I was really kind of, I was off, you know, and I wasn't off a great deal, but I was just off a little bit, and I shot a couple over, and that's all it takes on a U.S. Open. Gosh, it's such a tough layout and such a tough golf course and such tough rough, and you don't have to be far off to shoot two over. And I was three back going into Sunday, and so now the pressure was off. In fact, Sunday morning's paper didn't mention Strange going back-to-back against Ben Hogan. Yeah. The last is Ben Hogan. It wasn't mentioned. But I thought to myself Sunday morning, you know, it's such a hard golf course. Tom Kite is not invincible. It would be nothing for him to shoot. Ask him to shoot one or two over par and for me to shoot one or two under. And so, therefore, I could get part of a playoff. And that was my mentality. There was very little pressure. And I think I birdied the second hole, and you know, I got going pretty well. And then he made a triple on five, and the game was on. Now he's playing back to my strengths. He's playing back. I'm in the lead, or I wasn't in the lead, but I was closer. And I'll never forget. You talk about emotional times on the golf course. I played well the front side. I think I shot one under or something, and I was within one of the lead, or maybe even after nine, and. I birdied nine or birdied somewhere. I don't remember, but I'm walking down the 10th fairway, and a dear friend of mine who's passed, who was the Richmond Times-Dispatch sports editor, Bill Millsaps, he followed me every step of the way. He looked up at me and gave me a thumbs up, which meant I had the lead. And the game changed. The whole mentality of game on changed. It was mine now, if I could do my job. And I did. I really played well after that. I parred every hole. I birdied 16, and I won. And, you know, you have to be lucky. You have to play well. You have to be lucky. I was lucky that Tom Kite didn't play his best. But, you know, I gave myself a chance, and that's all you can do at a major championship. And I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you guys if it wasn't for the ability to hit fairways, the asshole in me enough to think I could do this again on the backside Sunday afternoon, because it's not easy to just have the test, I don't know, just to kind of enjoy it enough to where you think you're the arrogance that you have to have within to think you can do something like that. I don't know if everybody else you've ever talked to thinks like that, but you know, I had to believe in myself enough to be able to do something like this. And I always felt like when I played basketball in high school, I wanted to take the last shot for some reason. And I think that resonates when you come down the stretch of a golf tournament.
Yeah.
You've got to want the ball. You can't go hide in the corner somewhere. You've got to want the ball to take the last shot, to put yourself on the line, to fail. You got to be willing to fail.
I think to the point you made, Curtis, Bruce, we've heard this a number of times from our guests, the guys that have been able to close in major championships, they all share that same closer mentality, don't they?
Yeah. And takes a lot of, intestinal fortitude to do it, because as Curtis has mentioned quite often during this conversation, you know, you've got that pressure and you can feel it, but you just got to get it done. That's all, and it's not easy.
Yeah, there's no secrets to it. There's no shortcuts, and I think I learned a lot from players that I played with, great players that I played with, and the way they went about it. Tom Watson was a tough guy coming down the stretch, because I remember when he was winning all his tournaments, and he became a better ball striker later life, but he kind of drove all over the lot, but he made these 4 and 5 footers and got it up and down from everywhere to win big tournaments, and made one of the greatest shots in the history of the game at 17 at Pebble Beach to win the U.S. Open. And you don't do that happenstance. You're not lucky. When you do it time and time again, it's not luck. And Jack Nicklaus never missed a putt when it counted. Jack Nicklaus never missing. Have you ever seen Jack Nicklaus stand on Sunday afternoon in the middle of the 15th fairway at Augusta? One of the toughest second shots on any par 5 in the world. Have you ever seen him miss the green? I don't think I ever have. And hitting 2 and 3 irons and things like that. Trevino, you know, hit some incredible shots, and Arnold with his aggressiveness. I mean, Arnold was never scared to fail. And Arnold and I talked about that. You learn from these guys. And it's not just me, but it's the competitiveness of being, and I think early playing athletics in other sports helps along the way. It's a great thrill to win. It's a bigger thrill to beat the best. They didn't have to give me a check for money at that point in time. Just give me the trophy. That's all I wanted. And with all those great names on it, is something that when I look back on, means more to me than anything else.
You deserve it, friend. Had a fabulous career and a tough competitor, which is what you got to be. You got to be that way.
Well, people say that. Yeah, you do. I think, you know, what's the full package of the great of the guys in any sport? Any sport, you got to have hand-eye coordination. Yes, you got to be athletic. I think you have to be, in today's time, a certain size for your particular sport. But you also have to have this ability inside to want it more than anybody else. I don't know if that's the right word, want to be on that stage. I don't know the right way to describe it. But when you look at, when I think of the greats, you know, we throw around great and superstar way too often in sports. The superstar to me is guys like Pelé, and Gretzky, and Michael Jordan, and Jack Nicklaus, and Tiger Woods, and the true superstar. And the stars are those underneath them. And then the rest of us are just nice players. And in our game, we've had, we've had superstars and we've had stars. But it's to be able to play and learn from them is thrill enough. And, you got to remember that it wasn't. But yesterday, Bruce, you and I were traveling to the world amateur team.
Yeah, that's true.
Gosh,
yeah.
And that was the greatest thrill of our life. And we were very fortunate to do what we did for a living.
I might also say, relative to your last statement, there are a lot of people that have played golf with you that have learned a hell of a lot about how to play this game and how to win. So I wouldn't talk yourself down as much as you have today. You've a lot of folks love, man, they love watching you, man.
Well, that's very nice, and you don't know that plan. But you learn the little things that when you get on tour, you hopefully figure out the best way for you to play the game, and to put it in the fairway is priority number one for me, and sets up the rest of the hole or the rest of the golf course. But then you learn to get on tour, you learn how to hit the little bunker shots, the ones that really do take some guts to hit. Yeah. You learn to hit the chip. You learn to use percentages on certain chips, on certain shots, on certain these and certain that. And there's times where you have to throw the percentage out the window and take a chance. But I tried to always remember it was a long year. What was the best percentage over the long haul and the real long haul of a 30-year career? And when you look at it like that and you work the percentages out, which they do more today than we ever did, because they have the stats and they have the numbers. But and some of them are quite astonishing. But it's just kind of figuring out how do you play the game. I don't know. There's no answer. There's no rhyme or reason. But I think if you love what you do, and I was in love with my whole life, I was very fortunate.
Let's wrap up the 1989 win, which was your second in a row in the U.S. Open at Oak Hill in 1989. I was there on Friday. I mentioned that when we opened up the first episode. That was the day you shot 64. I was there to witness it. I don't know how many of your shots I saw, to be quite honest, but I do remember the four hole-in-ones that day on number six.
Yes.
Such an unusual day. Was it down in like a little bowl, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was in a little bowl. It wasn't a good hole location. It was something you'd expect one or two holes, hole-in-ones to be had. It kind of surprised everybody it was in this location, but hey, you go play golf. But it was something a little different, something to talk about.
Yeah.
Nick Price, Peter Jacobson, Mark Wiebe. How about this pull? And I don't remember the fourth.
Well, it wasn't Jacobson. It was Price and Wiebe. Jerry Pate.
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a two on a par five to win a two-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcast. Did I Tell You About My Albatross?
Jerry Pate, yes.
And Doug Weaver.
There we go. There we go.
That was the four, hole-in-one on that Friday. That was your final win on tour, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I played some really good golf after that. The next year at the U.S. Open, I had a chance to win and didn't. And the win kind of went out of my sails a little bit, for whatever reason it did. And it just never quite the anticipation, the anxiety, the being on edge kind of left me to some degree, which, as I said, I needed. So, but I was unlucky to not win a couple of times, but I didn't. And, but you know what? Some tournament somewhere has to be your last. I kind of like it to be the U.S. Open.
How about that?
Yeah. So
it was also Gary Player's last U.S. Open that year at Oak Hill. You've had a few other good finishes, and touch on the ones you want, but third in 84 at Wingfoot when Fuzzy won that playoff with Norman, 87 when Scott Simpson won at Olympic Club, and also 94 fourth at Oakmont by one, missing a three-way playoff that year. You had some other close calls, didn't you?
I did, and it was all – and all those – the two before the country club, I really felt like I had an outside chance, and it doesn't matter if I did or not. If I felt like I did, then the nerves were there. And it was all learning on that stage again, as I mentioned earlier. But I think the one that hurt more than anything else was in 94. I missed the playoff by one, and I had the lead on the backside after 14, and I had a one-shot lead, and of course Ernie Els had the lead going into that day and didn't play great that last day, but that doesn't make any difference. I had the lead and I let it get away, and I'll never forget the feeling in the locker room that day. It hurts. I mean, it hurts, but you just don't move on. The losses really, really hurt sometimes, I knew that it might be my last chance, and I didn't take advantage. But it wasn't that I played well and came close. It was that I should have won and felt like I should have won, and it hurt for a while.
I didn't summarize at the top your U.S. Open performance, but quite strong. 22 starts in the U.S. Open for Curtis Strange, 15 cuts made. He had 5 top fives and 10 top 25s. Bruce, I think most guys would take that record.
Wouldn't they, Dish? Wouldn't they just? Especially the two wins. I mean, that's still a great feat. And as I've said before, back-to-back is something pretty special. And there's only 7 people in the history of golf that's ever done that. So that's Curtis Strange is one of them.
Let's go back to the Masters, Curtis, a little bit. You had 20 starts there at Augusta with 14 cuts made, one top five, which was a T2 in 1985. That's the year that Langer won. You had tied with Seve and Raymond that year. Four top 10s, 10 top 25s. That second finish in 85, unexpected given the way you opened that tournament.
I shot 80 the first round. I was playing really well going into it, and I made a bogey or two on the front side. I was actually playing with Jay Haas, and I got impatient. I got mad. I got frustrated. I started going after pins. I started doing crazy stuff, and I shot 80. And it happens. It happens. And that's a golf course you can't, as Bruce knows so well, you can't get overly aggressive. And so it happens. I mean, I went home that night. I just had my second boy. Sarah just had her second boy.
Yeah.
10 days or the week before. So I said, you know, what the hell? I'll go home and be with Sarah for a week and a half or so, 2 weeks, be with the two boys, and I'll get over it in a hurry. And so made a plane flight home. Friday afternoon, and went out the next day and started up par, birdie, eagle, birdie. Now I'm on the cut line. and I played well. I shot 60, 65. It should have been 63. I shot 65 and I was pissed off.
I do that a lot.
so I really was. I let a couple really get away from me at the end. And so I was thrust back in the heat of the competition because it was playing hard that year, and shot 68 on Saturday, And now I'm one or two back of Raymond Floyd in the last group. And I'm thinking, and of course, it is a pretty good story when you think about it. 80 in the first round, and now you're in the last group on Sunday. And so I didn't care how I got there. But looking back on it, it would have been a hell of a story.
Ooh.
And then I shot 32 Sunday on the front side, and I had a friggin' four-shot lead. And the only thing I remember about that week is that I didn't win. And it was it's the hardest loss I've ever had to take, by far. By far. Sarah, I came home Monday morning, saw Sarah at the front door. We both hit the floor and cried. It took a long time to get over that one. But I saw Jack Nicklaus a couple weeks later at the Tournament Champions. He took me aside and he said, you know what? This can either make or break you, and I think it's going to really make you. Hang in there. And words like that, a wink of the eye, a pat on the back from guys that came before me that I respected so much means so much, and they don't realize how much something like that means. And it meant a great deal. And I went and played pretty reasonably well the rest of the year. But losing the Masters, you know the history.
Man.
You know the tradition. You know the place. You know everything about it. The green jacket, butler cabin. You know everything about it. And to leave there and not win when you thought you should have is a big blow. I got to ask you, Bruce, how did you do there?
I have my memory of the one that I let go there. I had a 3-shot lead going to 11 in 68 when the scoring problem happened between Golby and
on Jim Sunday.
No, Saturday. I got a 3-shot lead. 3-shot lead Saturday, going to 11, and I hit what I thought was a pretty good second shot. Come up a little bit short, hit the bank in front of the green, and kicked left into the water. And then I made about a 15 footer for 8. So that wasn't too good. But then I really played great the rest of the way that day. I think I birdied 12 and 3-putted 13 for a par, and birdied 15. So, you know, I sort of got over the 8, but I ended up didn't play all that good on Sunday. But I think that that 8 on 11 Saturday really. I guess it's hard to really forget about it, but.
It is. It's, you know, and I didn't know that, but we all have our stories. And the casual viewer, or maybe the big golf fanatic, doesn't know that, but I understand it. By you saying that, one shot changed the entire complexion of the way you were playing of the entire tournament for you. And, If the ball doesn't go left in the water, it's
right next to
the hole. Who knows what happens?
Yeah, it's right next to the hole.
Yeah, who knows what happened? And I completely understand. And it's happened to many players there because it is such a chaotic backside with eagles, birdies, you know, and bogeys all into play.
Yeah,
because of you know, a couple of water hazards, the par fives, tricky greens. That's why we love it. We love to hate it, don't we?
Yeah, that's true.
So, Curtis, I'll answer your question. Bruce Devlin in the Masters, 3 top fives, 5 top tens, 10 top 20s. He made 15 consecutive cuts, which is tied for 9th on the all-time list. And for many years, he was the answer to the trivia question. Who was the only guy to ever make an albatross besides Gene Sarazen?
What hole?
8.
You were always so long anyway. You can get it on there easy. the guys are hitting 5 irons in there now.
I know, it's unbelievable.
I laid up with a 4.
Not only that.
2 irons.
They're playing it 35, 40 yards longer than the way we played it, and they're hitting 5 irons in there. It's a joke.
I know. I didn't. That's one of those holes I kind of didn't want to hit a good one because I didn't want to have to hit a 3-wood by those
left-hand side. Left.
I just soon go. I just want to hit a 4-wood out to the right.
Pitch it.
Figured I could pitch it well enough to make right. birdie. But it's like at 13. 13 was an interesting hole because if you and I hit a good one, we'd have a 4-wood or 2-iron into that hole.
Right.
Well, I'd much rather have a 4-wood.
Me too.
But I'd much rather hit a neck off the tee and have to lay up so I didn't bring bogey into the equation.
That's true.
So it's what makes the golf course so great in the day. It still is great.
Yeah.
But some of the clubs they hit in there are so much shorter than what we did. You know, I said to somebody I was walking this year in a practice round. It was Tommy Fleetwood or somebody. And he hit it on 5, and he hit like an 8-iron in there from the back tee. And I said, you son of a gun, if you'd be playing, we'll see how good you really are if you were playing back there where I was playing from.
Hitting a 3 and a 4-iron in there.
Yeah, 3, 4, 5. Or 6. If I ever had a 6-iron into 5, I felt like I was drooling for making birdie. 6-iron.
Yeah.
You know, it was, and then there was so much harder and faster than anything we'd ever played. It was a shock to the system when you went to play Augusta National. I never felt comfortable until the weekend there because of the speed of the greens.
Yeah.
They were unbelievable.
And some guys never felt comfortable there, period. I remember talking to Hal Sutton, and you probably know this, Curtis, but Hal admitted to us, he said, I just had a bad, bad attitude coming onto that property. I just never was in the proper frame of mind at Augusta National.
Well, I can see that, and I can understand that, and I don't think anybody. Boy, it takes 3 days to get comfortable. If I had to do it all over again, I'd hit half as many balls there, and I'd spend half a day every day on that putting green, putting 30 and 40 footers,
yeah,
and downhill putts. I'd do it differently because that's the beast there at Augusta National, is putting those 30 and 40 footers up there, you know, 3, 4, 5 feet and having those all day long.
Yeah.
Augusta National, you were exhausted after every round because of those putts.
Yeah. Let's jump ahead to the Open Championship. And I guess my first question, Curtis, as I look and I sort of chart your entire major championship history here. And so I look and I say, okay, 1976, Birkdale, check. And then skip, 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 skip. And then 82 at Troon, 83 at Birkdale, skip, skip, and so on. What was it with you in the Open Championship? Because it seems like you obviously could have had a lot more starts, and yet you didn't.
Got to be stubborn. Got to be. It's a short story. You know, I didn't play. I played in 76. I just turned pro. I went over and qualified because I wasn't exempt on the U.S. tour. And then after that, it was not official money and I was not exempt. So I didn't play those years after that because I wasn't exempt and I was trying to make a living on the U.S. tour. So that's what happened there. The skip, skip, skip in the middle of the low 80s or the early 80s was stubbornness. It became official money sometime that time, but I just didn't go. I felt like I was needed more on the U.S. tour for my personal record and my personal play. So there was 1 or 2 years I wasn't exempt, but then I did skip 1 year in 1985 when I was exempt and I was playing reasonably well. So that was my mistake. I take full credit. I've said it on national TV. I've said it on world TV doing the British Open. It's the biggest regret I have in golf, not going over there when I was playing my best. But then after that, I learned to embrace it and I learned to enjoy it. And I went every year after that, that I was exempt, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I never played very well there. I don't know why. I never was able to go early because I had to play the week before. But that's no excuse. I just never got real comfortable over there. But I did learn to enjoy it. And it was just one of those things in your life that you make mistakes.
Well, to be fair, and Bruce, you'll back me up on this, because we've had the same discussion with several of our guests, right, who have had the same sort of regret. Charlie Cootie said, hey, I did have a game that was suited for Scottish-English golf because of the winds I grew up in, the hard, firm, and fast conditions. I actually did fine there, won a tournament, I think, at Birkdale. For much the same reason, he was there to put bread on the table of his family. And, of course, the deal was different back then, wasn't it, Bruce?
Yeah, and I think the key to it, Curtis just mentioned the key to it in my mind, is in those days, the Open Championship prize money was non-official. So it didn't help you with any of your exemptions unless you were fortunate enough to win. And I think back in those days, it was, I think, a 10-year exemption. I think it's only 5 now, but I believe it was a 10-year exemption then. So that was, I think that was the reason why a lot of players didn't do it. And then, of course, it's an expensive deal too, you know, pick up and buy. You normally like to take your wife with you, a couple airline tickets, hotels for, 10 days or so. It's expensive.
Yeah, it's expensive in the day. And the purse was actually even smaller than what we were used to. And it wasn't official money, and it wasn't official win either. Yeah. If you won the British Open, it did nothing for your U.S. tour. So that in itself was, it took basically at least 2 weeks out of your U.S. tour schedule, sometimes 3, the week before, the week during, and the week after because of travel. It was a real, real commitment, Bruce. Wow. And the great players did it. The ones who thought they could win could do it. But there was no really, really reason to do it if you didn't think you could win.
Yeah.
And it might not make sense now, but it made a whole lot of sense back then for everybody that didn't go.
Yeah.
And Curtis, I'll give our listeners an example of this. I'll take you back to 1968. Lee Trevino actually, instead of playing the Open Championship at Carnoustie that year, he elected to play in the GMO. The GMO in 1968 offered first prize money of $40,000. It was the second highest purse at $200,000 on the PGA Tour, and it was going right directly up against the Open Championship that week. So the winner, who that week was Dave Stockton in 1968. He wins $40,000. Do you know what they paid the winner for the Open Championship that week?
Probably 18 or 20.
3,000 pounds. It was $7,200 back in those days. So, which is something I don't think you had to deal with, Curtis, the following week was the PGA. So some guys going across couldn't even make it back for the PGA. Okay. So, they're giving up a lot. So, and that happened from time to time, at least back in those days. But the Open Championship wasn't counted in official PGA dollars or stats until 1995. So it was just different.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, it was just different.
A different deal. And so you can understand.
And it's one of the real ways the game has changed, in terms of changed, because you would not dare not go now.
No.
It would mean so much to you if you did win or just play well.
Yep.
Well, on the world stage.
And the game itself has become a world professional game now, not like it was back, 40 years ago. So today's guys are very thankful, I think, that they get an opportunity to go to play the Open,
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Let's finish up in the majors with the PGA Championship. 23 starts for Curtis Strange, 12 cuts made. He had 2 top fives, 3 top tens, and 6 top 25s. A couple good finishes, although, I know you like Oak Hill and you finished 5th and 80, but Nicholas kind of won that one in a runaway, didn't he?
Yeah, that was from my first introduction to Oak Hill, and it was a hard golf course. I really, really played well. And still finished 5th. It's you know, all those old golf courses, they had so much more slope in the greens than we were used to. They were hard in the day. My gosh, they were. I can't imagine playing them in the 40s or 50s. The PGA came at a time of the year, and this is no excuse at all, but I was kind of getting worn out a little bit. I'd always played a lot in the first half of the season. No excuse whatsoever. I had a real good chance to win the PGA when Payne Stewart won over Mike Reed in Chicago. But other than that, it wasn't my best tournament. And I don't know why, but it just didn't work out for me.
I remember that tournament at Kemper Lakes in 89 because I lived in Chicago at the time. I remember that like it was yesterday.
Boy, it was a good golf course for a modern golf course. I had a real chance on the last hole, and I didn't hit a good shot in it, and that one hung with me for a while. I had a chance to, if I birdie the last, I was going to get part of a playoff, or I thought I would get part of a playoff. But whatever the case is, you have your chances, and sometimes you take advantage of them, and sometimes you don't. And as I said, I've said many times, you seem to remember those you don't more than those you do. But it's a great championship, and I think moving it to early in the year has been a home run for them.
I agree.
So that sort of finishes up the major championship career for Curtis Strange. Of course, there's a lot of other things that we'll hold off for a future time to talk about because we want to talk about Ryder Cup. We want to talk about your broadcasting career. But early on, Curtis, I've got to mention this because this week happens to be the 25th anniversary of Tiger's debut at the Greater Milwaukee Open in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And you must have been there in some capacity because there is a fairly, I will call it, infamous interview, you with Tiger, probably on the Wednesday before his debut that year in 1996. And that interview is getting a lot of play this week because of the anniversary, but for other reasons. So why don't you take us back to that time and your sit down with, at the time, a kid, I think, who was 4 days removed from just winning his third straight U.S. amateur.
Yeah. I was with ABC Sports at the time doing their golf. And I asked my producer if I could do the interview, if I could get the interview with Tiger. This was his first professional tournament in Milwaukee. He says, okay, deal. So I went to him that Tuesday or so, and he says, sure, I'd love to sit down. So I got to do the interview. I got nervous. I was there twofold. I was playing. I was still playing a lot of the ABC events that I televised, and they allowed me to do that. And then I was doing the TV. So Wednesday afternoon, we had a sit-down. I did a lot of homework, a lot of work. Was nervous. I was nervous because I was out of my element now. It was my first sit-down mm-hmm. interview. And he was a young kid. He had a great record. But Bruce, as you and I all know, there's a big transition from amateur golf to professional golf.
Yeah.
And he was very honest. I knew him a little bit. I knew him to speak to him and talk and chat. And so it wasn't just meeting on the spot. And I knew enough to let him talk, set him up, and let him go. I asked the question, what would be a good result for you this week? He said, well, I go to every tournament to win. And he said, winning is what I come here to do, and second sucks, and third is worse. And it kind of caught me off guard, which is my mistake number one. It caught me off guard. And then I thought for a second, I said, well, do you realize how that comes off as arrogant or cocky to some of these old veterans who have been out here all year, their whole life, that understand how tough this game really is and how it would beat you up? He says, I understand that, but that's the way I was brought up. That's the way I take my attitude every week. And that's what I think about this week. And I thought for a second, I said, well, you'll learn. Mistake number two is that I didn't shut up. I said, well, you know what I mean. I kind of giggled. I said, you know what I mean. It's a tough game, blah, blah, blah. I should have shut up and let him fill the blanks, and I didn't. I said that you'll learn for, you know, it was on the spot quickly. Some of it to be a smart ass, some of that you will learn because this is a tough game.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of great Amherst come before you that didn't come out to be Jack Nicklaus or the future Tiger Woods. And knowing, Percival, how tough I worked at it and how tough the game was for a lot of people. So it went on. And it was a good interview. It came off great. He was terrific in the interview. Not another word was said for the next 15 years. 12 years until social media hit the airwaves.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
It went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.